You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. Our show features our team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. And they'll help you make the most of your money while cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. You'll get clarity on strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey everyone, thanks for tuning in to the 240th episode of our Civil War podcast. I'm Rich.
And I'm Tracy. Hello y'all. Welcome to the podcast.
As promised, now that we've finished with the Fredericksburg story arc, we're going to head from Virginia out to Tennessee to wrap up 1862 on the podcast with a discussion of the Battle of Stones River.
One thing we did want to mention here is that as 1862 was drawing to a close, there were important events happening on three different fronts. In Virginia, with Robert E. Lee and Ambrose Burnside, and also in Tennessee, with Braxton Bragg and William Rosecrans, and then also along the Mississippi, with Ulysses S. Grant. But we decided that with the various events that eventually culminated with Grant's capture of Vicksburg, what we're going to do is wait and cover them all in one big Vicksburg story arc that we'll get to on the podcast after we talk about Chancellorsville, but before our coverage of Gettysburg.
So that's really just to point out that, yes, we're aware that important things were happening out in the Mississippi River Valley at the end of 1862, like Holly Springs and Chickasaw Bluffs. But we're going to wait to cover those events down the road during the Vicksburg story arc. So, with that disclaimer having been dispensed with, let's start to set the stage for the Battle of Stones River, which is perhaps one of the most underappreciated battles of the Civil War.
But in fact, from November 1862 to July of 1863, both the Federals and Confederates engaged in major operations in Middle Tennessee that had a profound impact on the course of the Civil War. The opposing armies fought the war's bloodiest battle by percentage of loss at Stones River as 1862 turned to 1863. And after a pause in the action that spring, they clashed again during the Tullahoma campaign in June and July 1863, which resulted in total Union control of Middle Tennessee.
Let's be honest, most people have never even heard of Stones River and Tullahoma. The two operations in Tennessee were overshadowed by more famous battles in the east or along the Mississippi River. But nevertheless, they played an equally important role in determining the course of the war. Within the Confederate Army, seeds of mistrust and division planted in Middle Tennessee later bore bitter fruit in the fall of 1863. And after Stones River and Tullahoma, the Federals controlled the gateway to Chattanooga, which was their ticket to push on to Atlanta and into the Deep South. All of that's to say that the decisive campaigns of Chickamauga, Chattanooga, and Atlanta would have been impossible without Stones River and Tullahoma.
As y'all will recall, the Volunteer State's strategic location between Kentucky and the Deep South ensured that it would be a major battleground during the Civil War. Two key rivers, the Cumberland and the Tennessee, provided good avenues of advance for Union forces into the Confederacy.
Deeply divided, men from Tennessee served on both sides during the war. And Tennessee hosted many important battles, from Fort Donelson and Shiloh in 1862 to Franklin and Nashville in 1864.
Nashville was the first Confederate state capital to fall to Union forces in February 1862, and after that it became an important base for later operations against the Confederacy.
Both sides recognized Tennessee's importance and committed significant resources to this theater of operations. The Union and the Confederacy fielded their second largest armies in Middle Tennessee, the Federals' Army of the Cumberland and the Confederates' Army of Tennessee. Dominating both sides' strategy was possession of Chattanooga and its key rail junction, which was the vital link to Atlanta and the Deep South. The Union forces sought to push down the strategic axis of the Nashville and Chattanooga Railroad through Chattanooga and into Georgia, while the Confederates fought to halt and reverse the Federal advance. The failure of the Confederates to do so hastened the end of the war.
To start setting the stage for Stones River, we need to backtrack to the aftermath of the Battle of Perryville. As y'all recall, after his withdrawal from Perryville, Confederate General Braxton Bragg had decided there seemed to be little to gain from a continued presence in Kentucky. So the rebel army had begun a long retreat toward Cumberland Gap on October 13, 1862.
The Confederates moved through the mountains as quickly as possible, since they were dangerously short of food and fodder. Bragg's commissaries issued no rations, for the simple fact that they had none to give, and so the men scrounged what they could from the barren countryside during halts in the rapid march. When Kirby Smith's troops, at the tail end of the Confederate column, reached Cumberland Gap, Smith reported that his men had, quote, suffered on this march everything except actual starvation. There must be not less than 10,000 of them scattered through the country, trying to find something upon which to live. End quote.
Union General Don Carlos Buell followed Bragg's retreat until the rebels began to enter the mountains. Then he called a halt, thereby sparking the last round of controversy regarding his tenure as commander of the Army of the Ohio. You see, from Washington, Abraham Lincoln and General-in-Chief Henry Halleck pushed Buell to closely pursue the Confederates, but he refused.
Buell pointed out that, logistically speaking, the mountains were, quote, almost a desert, and he accurately predicted that the rebels would have to pass through them quickly or starve. Buell said that he couldn't catch up with the rapidly moving enemy, nor could he feed his own army in that barren country. Rather than undertake a fruitless pursuit of Bragg into eastern Tennessee, Buell instead wanted to take his army to Nashville and secure Middle Tennessee, and he started to lay plans for a movement in that direction.
But since early in the war, Abraham Lincoln had harbored hopes of rescuing Unionist eastern Tennessee from Confederate control, and now Buell's refusal to march down into that region, coupled with his recent failure to vigorously press his advantage in the immediate aftermath of Perryville, strained Lincoln's patience to the breaking point, and orders went out from Washington for William S. Rosecrans to relieve Buell as commander of the army.
And just as an aside, but the orders that gave Rosecrans command of the army also created the Department of the Cumberland, which he also commanded. Technically, Rosecrans' force at this time was not named the Army of the Cumberland, a name it would carry for the rest of the war. Instead, between October 30, 1862, and January 9, 1863, it was officially the 14th Corps, and it didn't become the Army of the Cumberland until January 9th. But for practical purposes, throughout this story arc, we're going to go ahead and call it the Army of the Cumberland. So, there you go.
Okay. Well, command of the army and this new department were essentially Rosecrans' reward for his recent victory in the hard-fought battle at Corinth in northern Mississippi, when he successfully defended that place against a major rebel attack led by Confederate General Earl Van Dorn.
Rosecrans arrived at Bowling Green, Kentucky on October 30, 1862, and took command of the Army of the Cumberland. Old Rosie, a nickname from his West Point years, which was quickly adopted by the men, immediately began to size up his army, since he was well aware that along with his promotion also came Washington's expectations that he take action against the rebels sooner rather than later.
I'm Jane Perlez, longtime foreign correspondent and former Beijing bureau chief for the New York Times. I've been a foreign correspondent in lots of places, Somalia, Indonesia, Pakistan, but nowhere as important to the world as China.
I mean, China is not dropping anti-democratic paratroopers into Montana. But of course, we did see things like the weather balloon slash spy balloon riveting the whole country for a week.
This is Face Off, an 8-part series in which we'll take you behind the scenes to key moments in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. We'll speak with a diplomat, a spy, a tech reporter, a U.S. admiral, even Yo-Yo Ma. Plus, my pal and noted China historian Rana Mitter joins the conversation. We'll look at what's driving the two nations apart and explore whether anything can help bring them back together. Face Off launches April 9th.
Hey there, I'm Dylan Lewis, one of the hosts of Motley Fool Money. Each weekday on Motley Fool Money, we talk through the business news you need to know and the stories moving stocks on Wall Street. On weekends, we dive into the industries shaping tomorrow and host the experts, authors, and executives that understand them. Tune in for insights, a long-term perspective on investing, and of course, stock ideas, plenty of them. To quote a listener, it pays to listen. Check us out and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Meanwhile, by the time Bragg reached Cumberland Gap, his superiors in Richmond wanted to know what he intended to do next. Confederate President Jefferson Davis's preference was to reoccupy Middle Tennessee because, he told Kirby Smith, no other move seemed more likely to compensate for, quote, the depression produced by the failure in Kentucky, end quote.
The authorities in Richmond actually still hoped that after resting and refitting, Bragg would take the offensive for a second time and re-enter Kentucky. But Braxton Bragg had soured on the bluegrass state and had no intention of trying that hazardous experiment again. And privately, nearly every observer recognized that Bragg's failed effort demonstrated the futility of Confederate attempts to conquer new territory. As one of the Army's engineer officers put it, quote, Bragg's campaign in Kentucky is pronounced here a magnificent failure, big show and no result, a march up the hill and down again.
All of Braxton Bragg's strengths and faults had been on full display during the Kentucky campaign, equally contributing to its successes and failures. Once the rebel army reached Knoxville on its retreat, Bragg boarded the train to Richmond on October 31st, to go and talk to Jefferson Davis about a movement into Middle Tennessee and also to clear himself of blame for the recently concluded unpleasantness in the bluegrass state.
There's no record of what precisely transpired during Bragg's conversations with Davis, but upon returning from the Confederate capital, the general was in an unusually good spirits, so it can be assumed Davis approved of his conduct in Kentucky. Although Bragg was apparently far less successful in painting Leonidas Polk as the scapegoat for the ill-fated campaign. Perhaps because, like Bragg, the Episcopal bishop turned rebel general Polk was also a favorite of Davis's.
Probably because he found Braxton Bragg's statements against Leonidas Polk to be suspect, Jefferson Davis summoned Polk to Richmond on November 3rd. The nature of Polk's trip to the rebel capital was no secret within the army. It was spelled out in Special Order 29, which said that the bishop was to report to the adjutant general in Richmond for, quote, the purpose of conferring personally in regard to the state of affairs in Military Department Number 2.
Well, the state of affairs was deplorable, Polk told Davis after his arrival in Richmond. The Kentucky campaign had been a dismal failure, and Bragg alone was responsible, Polk declared. And above all, a change in command was necessary. And on every count, Polk assured Davis that his fellow generals, William Hardee and Kirby Smith, were in agreement with him. He concluded by suggesting that Davis replace Bragg with Joseph E. Johnston. His business in the Capitol finished, Polk traveled to his Raleigh, North Carolina home on a leave of absence from the Army, a leave that was probably as welcome to Bragg as it was to Polk.
Kirby Smith was the next to visit Richmond, although Jefferson Davis had no doubt of what Smith would tell him, since the general had already made his objections to any further cooperation with Bragg abundantly clear. After the retreat from Kentucky, Kirby Smith's contempt for Bragg was complete, and before coming to Richmond, he had written to Davis saying so. Davis had written back, agreeing that the recent campaign had been a, quote, bitter disappointment, end quote, but reaffirming his confidence in Bragg.
Both Davis and Kirby Smith, then, knew what to expect from one another before their Richmond meeting. When they met, Smith made one final appeal for Bragg's removal and replacement by Joe Johnston, but Jefferson Davis reiterated his decision to retain Bragg, and an unhappy Kirby Smith returned to Tennessee. And so Jefferson Davis neither replaced Bragg nor transferred Polk or Kirby Smith. The Army was therefore fated to enter the upcoming campaign with a high command torn by discord and conflict. By his inaction, the Confederate president helped sow the seeds of defeat in Tennessee.
Once Braxton Bragg had the Confederate Army safely back at Chattanooga, he decided to move it 100 miles up to Murfreesboro, a town just 30 miles to the southeast of Nashville. Bragg's report shed little light on his motives for this move, but he was obviously intending to secure at least a portion of Middle Tennessee's rich farmland for Confederate use, and by taking up a forward position astride the Nashville and Chattanooga Railroad, the rebel army would block any federal advance toward Chattanooga.
While Bragg was moving the rebel army up to Murfreesboro, William Rosecrans was moving the federal army down to Nashville. The army was reorganized into three corps-sized wings. Major General George H. Thomas became commander of the 5 divisions of the center wing. You guys might recall how Thomas, a Virginian who had remained loyal to the Union, had been offered command of the army before Perryville, but he declined it, apparently because he didn't want to take over from Buell in the middle of the Confederates' invasion of Kentucky. At any rate, the powers that be in Washington obviously didn't appreciate that earlier refusal, since when Buell was sacked, Thomas was passed over for command of the army, and instead Rosecrans was brought in from Mississippi.
While George Thomas would command the center wing of the army, Major Generals Alexander McCook and Thomas Crittenden would lead the right and left wings respectively, with 3 divisions each. Then Rosecrans gave Brigadier General David Stanley the daunting task of reorganizing and revitalizing the army's cavalry. Prior to this, the cavalry had mostly been parceled out in penny packets of a few companies for the infantry brigade commanders to use as they saw fit. But Stanley pulled these mounted units together into 3 brigades and began to drill them relentlessly, while Rosecrans begged Washington for repeating rifles for them. By the beginning of the new campaign, the Union cavalry couldn't hope to match their Confederate counterparts, but they were learning fast.
Rosecrans also established 2 new units that would ultimately play key roles in the Battle of Stones River. He grouped all of his regular U.S. infantry into 1 brigade commanded by Lieutenant Colonel Oliver L. Shepard. Rosecrans intended that this brigade of tough, disciplined regulars would be a potent reserve force in any fight, essentially his ace in the hole during a battle. And then, feeling the need for a dependable cadre of engineer troops, Rosecrans ordered that two men from every company in the army be selected to serve as pioneers. He organized the Pioneer Brigade into three battalions under the command of the Army's chief engineer, Captain James St. Clair Morton.
While making those changes, Rosecrans also set out to address a major problem that needed to be fixed before the start of any new campaign, and that was the state of his supply line. Throughout the war, of the three major Union field armies, the Army of the Cumberland consistently had the longest and most vulnerable supply lines. Rosecrans' main logistical base was up in western Kentucky at Louisville, 183 miles away from his forward depot at Nashville. Two viable supply routes connected the cities, one by water and the other by rail, but low water that fall downstream from Nashville forced Rosecrans to bring in his supplies by way of the Louisville and Nashville Railroad.
The Louisville and Nashville Railroad, the LNN, entered Nashville from the north, where it linked up with the Nashville and Chattanooga Railroad to service traffic headed southeast. Almost every one of the LNN's 183 miles between Louisville and Nashville was highly vulnerable to raids by Confederate cavalry or rebel guerrillas. Back in August, John Hunt Morgan's cavalry had done serious damage to the line, including burning the 800-foot-long Gallatin Tunnel. By the middle of November, the LNN tracks were still operational only to Mitchellsville, necessitating a long and slow wagon trip over the remaining 40 miles from that point to Nashville. The railroad reopened all the way to the Tennessee state capital only on November 25th. On that day, the arrival of a train from Louisville made the front page of the Nashville newspapers. To put things in perspective, in the 365-day period from July 1, 1862 to June 30, 1863, the railroad was completely functional only 7 months and 12 days, and each closing of the LNN slowed or halted Rosecrans' supply buildup and operations.
Besides the problem of his vulnerable supply line, Rosecrans confronted another source of anxiety, the pressure coming from Washington for a forward movement against the rebels. Needing battlefield victories after Democratic gains in the 1862 fall elections, and with the Emancipation Proclamation set to go into effect on January 1, 1863, President Lincoln prodded his armies to make December campaigns to engage the Confederates in battle.
In December, Ulysses S. Grant's forces tried twice to take Vicksburg, but failed both times. In Virginia, Ambrose Burnside vainly hurled the Army of the Potomac across the Rappahannock River at Fredericksburg, only to suffer a humiliating defeat. Meanwhile, in Nashville, Rosecrans continued his buildup. As they had with Buell, Lincoln and Halleck pushed Rosecrans to take the army and liberate East Tennessee. But like Buell, Old Rosie also begged off because of logistical concerns. And anyway, Rosecrans was more focused on advancing southeast, reasoning that the fall of Chattanooga would by default force the Confederates out of East Tennessee. Rosecrans knew he needed to accumulate supplies in Nashville before starting off on a new campaign, and he was forced to use a good number of troops to guard the vulnerable LNN.
But Lincoln and Halleck in Washington were unsympathetic to Rosecrans' concerns, and on December 4th, Halleck wrote saying, "The President is very impatient with your long stay in Nashville. Twice I have been asked to designate someone else to command your army. If you remain one more week at Nashville, I cannot prevent your removal."
Rosecrans called Halleck's bluff by saying that he was, quote, insensible to such threats. But nonetheless, the message coming from Washington was clear. Rosecrans needed to bring the Confederates to battle before the end of the year.
That means it's time for this episode's book recommendation, and our recommendation this time is No Better Place to Die, The Battle of Stones River by Peter Cozens.
Don't forget you can find all of our book recommendations in a handy list at the podcast website, which is www.civilwarpodcast.org.
We wanted to let y'all know that just yesterday we released members episode number 70, which was part two about the plot to assassinate Abraham Lincoln as he traveled through Baltimore on his inaugural journey in February of 1861.
Yep, so the members of the Strawfoot Brigade can listen to that, including the newest members, Caitlin and Everett. We appreciate their support of the podcast.
And we also want to say thank you to Adam M. for his donation this past week.
As we wrap things up for this show, we wanted to remind you that the music you hear at the beginning and end of every episode of the podcast is from the song Midnight on the Water, and we use it with the kind permission of Spiritwood Music.
Thanks for listening to this episode of The Civil War, 1861 to 1865, a history podcast. Rich and I do hope that you'll join us again next time, but until then, take care.
Thanks, everyone. Bye.